This is an ABC podcast.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour. Oh, yeah.
So do we blame baby boomers for everything at the moment, from the housing crisis to cost of living to aged care? To quote one of our guests that you'll hear from today, the idea that baby boomers are this rich, selfish, greedy generation who have sucked up all the wealth and are keeping it to themselves is just bonkers. So what do you think? And what's the reality of being someone who is aged between 55 and 74? Yes, baby boomers had free education, and many believe it was too easy to buy a house or two, and now the younger generation is suffering as a result. But boomers were also the protest generation, the Vietnam War generation, and the rock and roll generation. Boomers are now taking the load of childcare for their adult kids. They're the most likely generation to volunteer. And when we talk about the bank of mum and dad, well, they're mainly boomers. And not all boomers are rich. Is that just another stereotype? So are baby boomers scapegoats? And have we got them all wrong?
ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
So do we blame baby boomers for everything at the moment, and are they simply a scapegoat? And have we got the stereotype all wrong? My name's Rochelle Hunt. Joining you this hour, Dan Woodman, the Professor of Sociology at Melbourne University. A warm welcome back to The Conversation Hour, Dan. And also in the studio, Brian Nankervis, of course, of The Friday Review, and baby boomer himself. Dan, first things first, what defines a baby boomer?
It's the years that they were born. So we're talking 1946 to 64. And a lot of the generations are a bit woolly in on really what exactly defines them. Someone makes up the name. But the baby boomers were actually a demographic event. This was a baby boom. So after the Second World War, people were expected to, they wanted to, and had the opportunity to have kids, and they did. And so when the boomers were young, they were about 40% of the Australian population. So as they've gone through their life course, they've had really different lives to each other, and it's right to get away from, you know, when we talk about these generations, we put on our avocado colored glasses and use these stereotypes of the millennials used to get it. They ate all the toast and couldn't buy houses. But then the millennials got jobs in the media, and now the boomers are really, really copying it. And they are a vast, varied generation that's done so much across their life course, but they have shaped Australia. This was a big cohort. Yeah, that weight of the size of the group has meant that their life has made a difference for every cohort that was around them as well.
We do think at the moment anyhow, because of, I guess, just the conversation and the lens that we're throwing onto baby boomers, we think about money, we think about property, we think about retirement. But Brian Nankervis, when we think about baby boomers, do we think about the cultural revolution, the music in particular, the birth of rock and roll, Elvis, the Beatles, Woodstock, Flower Power, Sunbury, you name it. Do you think that's being lost in some way?
I don't think so. I mean, it probably rolls towards cliche a little, but it's a happy cliche. I mean, if the cliche is protesting in the streets, civil rights movement, the remarkable festival of Woodstock, the remarkable music came out, the Beatles. Well, that's not a bad cliche to follow. But then what happened after that? You know, it's only a few steps between Woodstock and Altamont where many believe it all went wrong. As a proud boomer, I suppose, I don't really, it's funny, I don't use that term much. And when your fabulous producer, Amber, mentioned that you were doing a show based around this idea, I thought, oh, hang on, is that me?
No, I am. Are you talking about me?
I probably should have thought more about money and retirement and superannuation, and I didn't. And maybe many of our generation got so carried away with that freedom of the 60s, with the remarkable blossoming of music. I mean, we heard a little clip of the Beatles at the front there, then we moved nicely into Bob Dylan. They say that when the Beatles went on Ed Sullivan in America, I think it was June maybe 1964, it completely changed the sort of pop culture, because there were so many people in their lounge rooms watching, and they all thought, well, that looks pretty simple in a way. It also looks like a lot of fun. I can do that.
I know not too long ago we spoke about what defines Gen X, you know, that apathetic generation, but then we were talking about the birth of music and grunge and pop culture sort of coming into its own. Lots of boomers were texting in saying, hang on a minute, man. When you talk about cultural revolutions, when you talk about the birth of movements and moments, then we, the boomers, we don't pay enough respect to, I guess, the path that you paved for us.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think you can get hung up on that and respect and who's, and, you know,
who's cooler,
that idea
who did
of,
more.
Yeah, of all of the teasing, okay, boomers. I mean, it just ends up being easy to grab headlines, but it was in a way a simpler time, and so there wasn't this bombardment of the media, and it crossed all sorts of generations and types. For example, I grew up in North Bourne, a very, very strong area for young families. I grew up as part of a church. The church youth group, we would have upwards of 100 kids every Saturday night doing these activities, you know, daggy activities, but fun, bowling, car rallies, square dancing. But that church also contained leaders who were going to university and who were marching in the moratorium. So they were quite politically motivated. There's Jonathan Franzen's latest book called Crossroads does a similar thing in America. And it was like, okay, you're part of the church, you're part of what seems like it's a conservative organization, but there is strong threads to civil rights and to protesting. I mean, it was interesting hearing you talk about we're the ones that volunteer, but also, I mean, let's not completely forget what the youngsters are doing. You go to the marches in the city on a Sunday about the Middle East, and that is a strong cohort of youngsters. They care. They, you know, I think it's wrong to just think it's just the boomers.
Do you think that the elders, that sort of fight between millennials and boomers is real, or is that just something being perpetrated by the media?
I'm not really one to comment. I don't take any notice of it. I keep forgetting
who is a millennial.
Well, I keep forgetting how to say it. I keep forgetting what year and who is Gen X and who is Gen Y and what's a millennial.
Maybe that's a good way for all of us
maybe
to be.
Maybe it is.
Well, there's a text here that says, Brian is very Gen X for a boomer. We know you have an important interview to get to with Beth Orton that will on the Friday review. Yeah. If you have time, pop back in later.
I will. I maybe come back at the end. That'd be fun.
That
and
be fun.
See,
we'll fill
see
you in.
How you got and how much Bob Dylan you played.
Well, you know me and my Bob Dylan stance. Thank you, Mr. Brian and Curvis. You are on the Conversation Hour as we try and pull apart what defines being a boomer, and are we blaming them for everything at the moment, and have we got them all wrong?
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky.
Are we blaming boomers for everything, and do we throw them into this small little window of being cashed up, counting their properties and about to retire in a big fancy caravan, maybe giving some of their money to their kids or not? Is that a simplistic view of what a boomer looks like? Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, Dan Woodman, Professor of Sociology at Melbourne University, with you as well. Brian Nankervis there mentioned a couple of things. University, which is one that we'll get to. Family, which is one that we'll get to. But the role of music and the role of popular culture, we just heard a heap of TV programs there, they still define us now, don't they? Do we take that for granted, Dan?
Yeah, so like I think there's this funny thing that Brian pointed to where we kind of know their stereotypes and we can kind of get riled up about them, but the ones that make us look good, we don't mind so much. You know, the kind of greatest music might just happen to be the music from my youth. One of the things about music that's really interesting is it does also connect the generation. So some personally, for me, it was the record player in the family house and pulling out some of Mum and Dad's records that was my first exposure to music. So it was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Elvis, you know. When I was a 19-year-old and finally got out of Australia, one of the first things I did was spend a week at the Beatles Festival in Liverpool watching some, let's say, middling to mediocre Beatles cover bands. And I got that from my mum, and she was one of these Melburnians who was out there as a teenager seeing them when they came to Melbourne. But the irony of all this is that the Beatles and almost all of the Stones and Elvis, they're actually not boomers. You know, the boomers were teenagers when there was this explosion in popular culture. But the people who were leading that were just a little bit older, born during the war years or just before.
Daniel's in St. Albans. Morning, Daniel.
Hi, Rochelle. Yeah, I'm a classic baby boomer, 76 years old. That means born in 47.
Yep.
Eventually got to university with the Whitlam assistance, and I'm still working at 76. But I don't feel like a baby, like I don't have a label on me, and I don't think that most of the people I know my age, we don't have that label. We're just people.
The idea of this real kind of disdain between millennials and boomers, like here's just one of the texts, right? And it says, well, I would have loved to have gone out and protest or marched whilst I was at university, but I had rent and hex. I was working to keep a roof over my head and to pay for textbooks and good when I wasn't actually in class. I'd love to enjoy this generation's version of rock and roll, whatever that is, but we choose a mortgage or a concert ticket, I guess. Is it real? Is the tension real, Daniel? Do you feel it?
No, not at all, and neither do my children who are, I suppose, you millennials, you know, between 25 and 35 in age. And in fact, they're out protesting on about the Middle East, and, I mean, they do whinge a bit about Hexted, which I've given them a bit of hand with, but no, there's not a tension at all, I don't think. I just don't feel it. I think it's a media thing.
There's a lot of people, Brian himself included in this, that are actually surprised when they sit down and think, oh, actually, I'm a boomer. There's a text here that says, oh, dear, I was born in the 1960s, so I guess I'm counted as a boomer. Do boomers care, you know, like Daniel from St. Albans, do boomers care about any of this? And lots of messages saying, stop pigeonholing people and putting labels on people. Do other people care about boomers, but boomers don't care about being a boomer?
Look, the generational talk when it becomes about an individual and acting like they have a certain set of attributes because of when they were born. I think we talked about this when we talked about Gen X. It's kind of like astrology, and you know, I'm not into astrology because, you know, probably because I'm a Virgo or whatever it is. But it doesn't really capture the individual. There is this grain of truth to the idea, which is that. Our times shape how our life course unfolds, and being part of this big cohort really did make a difference, and it shaped culture. But the thing to remember is that it was a protest generation, but the vast majority weren't out protesting. It was the generation of free university, or not for the oldest boomers, but for the kind of big chunk in the middle. But most boomers didn't go to university. Until the 1980s, we didn't have most people finishing high school. So most boomers had a very different transition to adulthood. So you know, their parents didn't finish primary school often. So that was who their parents were. And then they studied a bit further, but they weren't actually taking up this free university.
Jackie's in St Kilda. Morning, Jackie.
Good morning. I was born in the 40s and I came to Australia in the 60s as a migrant and with lots of other European women. And my first job application to a state government body, I was told that they didn't employ married women. And there it ended. We that's where we started. Low pay, no super. 30 years later, I started a self-managed fund.
Yeah.
But I still, and any lady today, we know that men have more super than ladies, and I am not allowed to make it up to the equivalent of a man unless I pay a financial price.
And Jackie, it's part of the reason why women like yourself, and we're going to speak to the Women's Property Initiative a little later, it's part of the reason why women over the age of 50 are the fastest growing group of homeless. Because you potentially, if you wanted to, you could have stayed home and raised your children. If you had a family, there was no super. So if you then separate, divorce, or become a widow, you're really left in an awful situation, aren't you? And the bank's not going to lend you any money. Let's talk superannuation and how that impacted women in particular for boomers. We're going to speak property a little later. Is there a pivotal time? I mean, we talk about boomers being cash up, but I mean, look, there's a text here that says you just clearly don't realise how many boomers have nothing. Probably only one third of boomers went to university. Most were working before uni became free. Some might be rich, but some may not.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It was even less than a third that went to university, quite a lot less. And people made relatively early transitions into work. And there was a gender divide, because particularly for young men, that was a bit more structured, big intakes into apprenticeship programs and those kind of things. But the boomers were in the early stages of the working life, but well into work often, before laws like having to resign from the public service when you got married and these things disappeared from Australia. And there wasn't super for the early part of their working life. And then the boomers cohort did start to change working patterns a little bit, but a lot of women did have a period out for caregiving, and then with super, you know, not there before, they took that time out. It's been impossible
to catch
up.
About, isn't it? Really, I mean, that's not that long ago.
Yeah.
And if you think about life without superannuation and what that would look like, people fight for it now, fight really, really hard for it now. But that fight started with the boomers.
Yeah, a lot of the positive changes that have come up around in the workplace over the last, say, 50 years were this big cohort coming through the system and pushing for change, you know, with their unions and others. But this cohort did, in that sense, make things better for generations to come.
I was born in 1961. I might be a baby boomer. Yes, I'm tired of the stereotype. I own my own home, which I'm lucky to have, but I don't own a car or another property or go on holidays. Yes, I've helped my sons with a small amount of money for deposits because I was made redundant. I've been a single parent. I've worked in any job I could find, not a lot of super. Please don't label me. Where does this labelling come from? And I really feel like the tension that's being thrown around at the moment, as we've heard from some of our talkback callers, it's just not helpful. Are boomers scapegoats in this?
I would say yes, but with just a little bit of caution, in that the people who get to do the viral posts, but also are writing for our big news organisations now, tend to be younger. The boomers are really almost all out of the workforce now. And there was a time not that long ago where the millennials were really feeling like they were the ones copying it from the labels, you know, that they're narcissistic, they're not making proper transitions, they're wasting their money. And when we use the labels like that, it's not helpful, and it is also misleading, because almost every millennial, even ones who don't like the way our property market is structured right now, tend to like their boomer. You know, not always, but most of us like our family. And there's actually lots of intergenerational assistance that we're hearing from the callers as well. So the way I like to use these things is to think about how they might point to the way Australia's changed. And that's not to say it's all better or worse, you know. Some parts of getting your feet at work were easier overall on average for the boomers, but when they were kids, they also found it much easier to catch polio. So, you know, it's really hard to say overall whether things are better or worse, but they have changed.
And they were children whose parents lived through the Depression. Yeah. So that comes with a certain lens that is thrown over a family. I've only got to think about my grandparents and the way they viewed money or house or family or what was a bad or dire situation, or if something bad happened to you, I'd always look to my nan and pa and go, all right, I think I'm okay. I think I need to get over myself a little bit as well. So there's so many things. The whole bank of mum and dad. And then that's another thing that I feel like has been generated. It was something that Malcolm Turnbull first threw around. We stuck to that. generally it's boomers that if you're going to be a bank of mum and dad, you're going to be in that age bracket. Is that something else that's really unhelpful and is potentially generated either by the media that came from one particular political comment?
Well, the way we talk about it can sometimes be unhelpful because it does pull questions away from how we actually structure our society and our property market. But the Bank of Mum and Dad is a real thing. So in my research, we've been tracking a number of generations after the baby boomers as they go through to adulthood. And our group who are buying houses now or trying to or wish they could, and even just like dealing with the cost of living crisis in their 20s and 30s, a huge number of them are getting help from the Bank of Mum and Dad. And in terms of buying houses, we've seen it go from almost no one getting help, you know, maybe 10% to two-thirds really quickly who are getting some help when they're first home buyers in this cohort. And we found in our research is that parents across the class divide are doing this. Obviously, they can't help to the same extent. If you've got $1 billion, you can help a lot easier than if you don't. But there is this kind of pressure or expectation now that a lot of boomers are feeling that actually we're going to have to help our kids if they're going to make it.
Yeah, what if you don't want to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What if you want to go on a really big holiday?
Yeah.
So do baby boomers get the blame for everything at the moment, from the housing crisis to aged care? And is the stereotype helpful in any way?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
So do we blame baby boomers for everything? And what is the reality of being a baby boomer? There is this image at the moment that baby boomers have got multiple properties, are uber rich and are about to retire and lead a really fabulous life. That may be the case for some, but in actual fact, baby boomers at the moment are providing childcare for their adult children. They are the most likely to volunteer and to give up their time for free. Baby boomers are the protest generation. They are the generation that helped shape rock and roll. So have we got them wrong? Dan Woodman, the Professor of Sociology at Melbourne University, is with you. And Professor Clive Hamilton from the Charles Sturt University joins you now as well. Where did this stereotype come from, do you think, Clive?
Well, that's a good question, because when we think back to the 90s and 2000s, when the government was commissioning Treasury to write intergenerational reports, all the news stories were about how the baby boomers, when they retired and got old, would be such a massive burden on younger generations. And now, 20 years later, it's reversed. So instead of boomers being too poor, they're now too rich on these multi-million-dollar houses and these massive super balances. So I think many younger people are kind of looking for a scapegoat. And rather than identify it in a basically unequal society, they displace that onto the older generation. But of course, like in all generations, there are rich boomers and there are poor boomers. For example, 50% of boomers have super balances less than $180,000, and most of them, a majority, will rely on the pension in retirement. 30% of them are renting, and the fastest growing cohort of homeless people is women over 55.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be speaking to the Women's Housing Initiative in just a moment about that. There's also texts here, Clive, that say boomers were even shunned for having children out of wedlock. It was a really big deal. I hope we've made it easier and more comfortable for later generations. There was a lot that baby boomers went through, I guess, in their younger years that we don't think about.
Oh, indeed, and a lot is attributed to them that we do think about too much. For example, the fabled free university education, which prevailed for a decade or so, but very few boomers went to university in those days. Most people left school early, went to do trades or clerical work. Perhaps 10% of boomers went to university, and yes, they enjoyed free university education, but it was the injustice of that led to the introduction of HECS. I think why should poorer working people be paying for middle-class kids to get degrees that would allow them to earn a lot of money. But yeah, look, we don't want to romanticise it, but it is true that incomes when boomers were kids were perhaps a quarter or a third of what they are now. And so I think many younger people forget that or imagine that what they have now has always been, where in fact it hasn't. I was just noticing the other day a tweet from David Astle about words that Gen Z's don't understand, like pull the chain. I mean, there are so many aspects of life now that younger people take for granted that have been, you know, quite recent in their development.
I wonder, and I'd like to get this from both of you, whenever we talk about generations, whenever we talk about housing, there will always be this element and this debate on text and through calls saying, well, we worked harder or just as hard. This next generation don't realise how hard you do have to work. There's a text here that says, and then on the flip side, younger people will say, it's harder now than it was in the 50s or 60s. There's one just here that says, they have time to give up to volunteer, meaning the boomers, but younger people now just don't have the time. Parenting is more intense than ever. That's just a useless metric. Every time now I've tried volunteering, it's collapsed because I don't have childcare or it's business hours and I work. Is it harder now? Because that argument will come through all the time. I'll put that to you, Dan.
It's one of these things where if I say yes or no, one of
you're
those two groups
way,
is
right?
going
really
to be
set you up.
Yeah, yeah, and as I was saying before, like it's really hard to agree on what criteria you use to say overall life has got better or harder. Parenting is more intensive, but a lot of baby boomers, again, maybe they don't want to, but they're helping with that childcare as well. But that means that if you don't have that parental help, it can be tougher when your kids are young. The housing market, when interest rates go up, it gets harder. But for a little while there, where interest rates were a bit lower, making the repayments definitely wasn't harder than before, but maybe getting that deposit together was harder. But again, then that's when the bank of mum and dad was stepping in. So the world has changed. But instead of setting up a kind of battle between the generations, in fact, it's meant that we've kind of put the social contract that we had back into the family a little bit. So people are relying more on their baby boomer parents than their baby boomer parents probably had to rely, you know, on average, again, on their parents to make some of those transitions.
Clive, I want to hear from you in just a moment as well, but let's have a quick chat to Ian, who's in my hometown of Moi.
I get a little bit wound up when I hear about all this baby boomer stuff, because like we did it pretty tough. Like I'm at the late end of the baby boomer, 1960, but we did it pretty tough back in those days. The wages were extremely low. I know when I did my apprenticeship with the SEC back in the day, I couldn't get super because I wasn't a staff member. I was only a worker. So it was not till the probably the early 80s before I could even get super as a man. Women were even worse off. University changes were brought in by Gough Whitlam to try and get people to go to university, purely because most people weren't going there. They couldn't get through the high school to a state to get to university, especially if you were rural. You couldn't afford to go to a big city to live there.
Absolutely not, yeah.
So that was the reason that was brought in, to encourage people to go to university. We would buy a house. We bought our first house. We couldn't afford the newest and latest and the best. You buy an old house, you do it up. You had to buy an old car and work your way up to a good car. Nowadays, they buy everything brand new, top of the line, and then whinge about the interest rates. They're on 4%, we were on 17% interest rates.
And we hear that quite a lot. There's a text here that says, wah, wah, millennials, work hard, find the time. Clive, do you agree with Ian? I mean, is this sort of just a pointless debate? Does it really just depend on the time and your circumstances?
Well, I mean, I think that Dan's right when he says that life is more intense and complicated nowadays, but you know, the, blaming boomers for it is quite bizarre. I mean, boomers experienced that too. We did a study several years ago when we asked people about retirement and their retirement plans. And we found that, and whether they plan to keep working beyond the statutory retirement age. And lots of middle-class white-collar people said, yes, I want to keep working beyond retirement. But a lot of people who were engaged in manual labour said, well, I'm going to have to because otherwise it's the pension. But my body's broken down. And so it's just, you know, I can't. And so we have to keep in mind that the experience of Burmans was very diverse. And when it comes to volunteering, some can because they've got more time.
Mm.
And people who complain they don't, who are younger, don't have time. Well, you know, they're going to get older, and they're going to experience.
And I wonder how much of it actually just simply comes down to that. There's a text here that says, "Boomers have worked for a lifetime to get where they have. Is it possible that the younger generation will also be in a similar position after they've worked for a lifetime? Are we just not comparing, you know, apples with apples?"
You often see this in the research where someone will say there's this generational difference.
Well, because
it's actually like it's an age difference, right? So the passion that people hold for the music of the late 1960s is kind of about that generational experience, but also people like the Beatles more because they were there and experienced it. So these things can just be age effects. What I worry about it is losing, if we throw out the generational talk completely, is losing that particular lens on how Australia has changed that actually tells us about the economy and society. And maybe not the millennials will have it harder, but potentially we've got settings at the moment that might make inequality worse and make people more reliant on that intergenerational support. So those are the kind of things I think we should be using this as an opportunity to talk about more than, you know, one generation has it easy or hard.
This, why are so many people saying that having children is harder now? No childcare at all when mine were at preschool. I worked full-time from the moment both of mine were at school. And Mim says, this is a strange conversation. Things are different now. That's all. I'm a millennial and people will always find something to complain about and find a reason no matter what their generation. Labels are of no use whatsoever. Just finally, Professor Clive Hamilton, are these labels thrown around and the baby boomer millennial debate and the bank of mum and dad, how much of it is actually just political spin to try and make boomers a scapegoat, do you think?
Well, I mean, what I'm struck by is the extreme bitterness that's expressed by some younger people. I'm thinking of a popular comedian, for example. And I think, whoa, and a lot of younger people do take this in and really
believe. You're right. It is quite bitter. It can be quite bitter.
Because there are a huge number of boomers who are very concerned about inequality, about social injustice, about the difficulties their children and grandchildren are having. And lend a hand financially, but also, as you mentioned, grandparenting. Grandparenting is an enormous form of childcare in Australia. And what it does, it allows daughters and sons to work longer. Often grandparents stop their work or reduce their hours in order to be able to provide childcare. And so that's a kind of large financial transfer to younger people. So we need to keep it in perspective, I think. A lot of boomers would strongly support policy measures to make it easier for younger people.
Good to hear from you. Thanks so much, Professor Clive Hamilton from this Charles Sturt University. So many texts. Apologies if I can't read them out. Here's just one of them. Wasn't there a war and conscription as well for boomers to deal with? Vietnam War is something we haven't touched on, Dan.
Yeah, the generation of boomers kind of did come of age in fairly exciting times, euphemistically. You know, there was conflict, maybe not the World War, but there was a Vietnam War. There was that fear after the Second World War as well of that nuclear apocalypse that kind of floated there behind in the background of people's existence. And young people today obviously have a version of that, absolutely, with the climate change, and they're protesting rightly against slow action around that. But it wasn't that the boomers just saw saw this world that was, you know, free and easy and was going to unfold without any risks. They did risk being drafted, and they also did grow up in that time of the worry about nuclear war across the globe.
Steve's in Janjuk. What did you want to share?
From our perspective, like, I was born 61, so our kids have only known success and some sort of middle to upper income level living. So they didn't witness their parents. Yeah, we didn't always get what we wanted and whatever. So it's not necessarily their fault that they want what we have now, because that's all they've grown up with.
It's interesting, isn't it? My husband and I talk about that now, because the lives my husband and I lead now are very, very different to what the lives our parents lived, the lives we lived. And maybe we've broken some generational poverty and generational education. But then, Steve, I've lost track of the amount of times we started sentences with my daughter of when I was a kid, and I never thought I would say that, but we say it all the time, because you don't know how else to educate them that, oh, my God, you're so lucky. Do you realise how lucky you are? Good to hear from you, Steve. Thank you.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
Good morning, Michelle Hunt and Dan Woodman with you. Dan is a professor of sociology at Melbourne University. As we look at why we seem to be blaming boomers for everything at the moment, when we throw around the term boomer, it's almost used, Dan, you know, as an adjective to sum up a particular type of person. But when we think about older women and we think about the role that women had maybe when they were raising their families, if you wanted to, you could stay at home potentially and raise your kids. But we also know there was no superannuation. There was an expectation maybe that women wouldn't work. So the role of women then, who are now boomers, that's something that doesn't get discussed as much.
The generation of the boomers was kind of a high point or a low point. I guess it depends on your perspective. Of people got married quite young, and they had their children quite young, because the generation before were kind of delayed by things like the Depression and a world war that pulled back some of those transitions. And then generations after have taken longer before they did those things. So it meant that a lot of young women weren't really that well established in the labour market by the time they got married and had kids, and they didn't necessarily find it easy to then go back to high paying jobs when their kids got a little bit older. And they were pathbreakers really for new ways of working and pushing for gender equality. But the outcomes or the kind of lagging effects of that life course they've had means that a lot of baby boomer women, particularly when there is a divorce, find themselves in dire financial straits.
Well, someone who knows this all too well is the CEO of the Women's Property Initiative, Jeanette Large. Jeanette, unfortunately, we know that women over the age of 55 are the fastest growing group of homeless for all of the reasons that Dan just outlined. So when we sort of loosely throw around this term baby boomer, meaning someone that is well off and rich and potentially owns multiple properties, that couldn't be further from the truth for a lot of women.
No, you're right, Rochelle, and good morning. So absolutely, among older women, they're actually growing at almost 40% in homelessness between 2011 and 2021. So we are talking about, from our point of view, we see many, many older women who you'd consider to be boomers, who are not doing well at all. And for some of the reasons that you've already said, you know, the women who have stayed at home and in those caring positions have worked part-time. I'm actually a boomer myself. Mm. And in my first few positions, there was no superannuation contributed to, you know, from my employer. And it's only in the later years that I have had to really, really push to get that superannuation myself. And I'm doing fine. But, you know, there's many women out there, older women out there, who are not doing well at all. And, you know, you have said they work part-time, they take time out of the workforce, they don't have superannuation behind them. And it's not just the pay equity isn't just the issue that we hear about often, about the difference in the pay equity for the full-time jobs. It's the fact that so many women work in the lower paid positions. Those lower paid, really important caring positions, childcare, aged care, community sector, education, health sector. Women make up about 70% of those positions, and about 40% of those positions are part-time or casual. So all of this has an absolute cumulative effect for women when they get older. And as you say, particularly if they're separated or divorced and have been relying on possibly having that superannuation from a previous partner, they can be in a dire situation. So there's many women out there who are not doing well.
Absolutely, that are nodding their heads. Jeanette, stay with us, because Justine, you're in Sandringham and this is something that concerns you.
Yes, absolutely. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on air. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, it does. I went through financial abuse when my children were 4 and 6, with bank accounts completely emptied out and left with nothing. I've had to work so incredibly hard, and I'm quite a strong person, but it's taken me decades. And I'm born in 1963, and it's just taken so much strength and courage. My sons are now 24 and 26, and they're incredible individuals, but I'm so far behind. I'm still renting after all of this time. I have previously owned houses. It's just a shocking.
You wouldn't probably even be able to get a loan if you tried, Justine, even if you were really financially secure. I mean, I just hear time and time again, the banks say not a chance.
Yeah, I'm hoping, interestingly, I've actually just attempting to purchase a property at the moment. I've had plenty of knockbacks. I've built up my, been working, built up into a better job. I'm still hoping, but who knows? You know,
absolutely.
I've got my fingers and toes crossed, but the government needs to help. I never seem to fit in anywhere. You know, I did pay for my university. I've just had to work incredibly hard, and I am very, very worried about the tsunami of homelessness that's about to occur for older women.
I think lots of people are. Justine, I really wish you all the best, and I really hope that you get that home for yourself and for your children. I mean, do you hear that all the time, Jeanette? Like, you know, as we literally just heard, I don't fit in anywhere, said Justine, that even if you're in a good job, those gaps that you fall through are so wide.
Absolutely. And look, we actually piloted an older women's housing program for women in that similar situation to what we've just heard. Because, yes, some women, you know, older women, they do manage to get back on their feet after they've had a separation or a divorce or, you know, the dreadful situation that was just outlined there where bank accounts are cleaned out. But when they get older, it is so difficult for them to get back into home ownership, because even if they've got some savings behind them, the banks are not prepared to...
So should the government step in, like Justine just said? Should there be some kind of program for women in particular?
I think so. We've been encouraging the government very much to adapt, I suppose, their shared equity programs. So they have shared equity programs out there, but it's very much for the younger people who can continue to add to that equity within their house. But women, these older women could come with a much higher equity in the first place, but they won't be able to add to it significantly depending on their age and depending on their work and their employment. But, you know, the government isn't going to lose out if it's a shared equity. It gets that woman into some sort of home ownership, not fully owning the property. It means they're in safe, secure housing. The impact, you know, for anyone who's in safe, secure housing on their health, that physical health, their emotional health, the savings to government even just in those areas.
And the benefits to the entire community. There's a text here that says, we had to resign from our jobs when we had our babies, and when we tried to get a job, we were treated like imbeciles because we'd been out of the workforce looking after our children. Did you experience that at all, Jeanette?
No, I didn't experience it personally, but I know many women who have and have made it. It's been really difficult for them to get back into employment. You know, they've contributed to society in so many ways, and any woman would tell you who's caring for children and so forth and managing a household, the skills and expertise they have in doing that, that they can contribute to a job. But Yes, no, I haven't experienced
that. Well,
this.
And I hope, I mean, just finally, I mean, any other countries, are the governments in any other countries doing what you spoke about? I mean, there's lots of texts now just flooding in saying, oh, I'm 64, I'm 67. The list and the age goes on saying, I can't get a loan. There's no way I'll ever own a house. I'm divorced. I'm widowed. Is anyone doing it? Like, is there a blueprint somewhere?
I don't believe there's a blueprint. I know some countries overseas have co-housing opportunities where older women can get together and live in a sort of a more of a communal environment. But I don't know of a, I don't personally know of a blueprint up overseas, but it could be something that someone might like to research. But, you know, we have actually put to our government in relation to the shared equity of how they can progress that. And, you know, it would be such a saving. It's less money in the first place than fully costing social or public housing because the woman would be contributing to it in some way.
Just while we have you, I want to bring Philippa in, who's called in from Sydenham. What was your experience, Philippa?
I had worked an excellent job in Sydney in the VIP lounge many years, and I went into the bank. I was engaged to my manager, but I went into the bank manager. He gave me a loan to purchase a house and a business, which I did, and continued working. My husband passed away, unfortunately, and I went down to Melbourne and tried to get a loan to buy or build a house here and open a business. And it took me, I think, four banks. I got a letter in the end that did allow me that. So I was working with no super. So my first husband passed away. I'm widowed the second time now. But also the attitude for financial systems don't work all of a sudden. It was amazing.
I know, and that attitude, there's, again, I can't keep up with the text from women that are saying very similar things. Philippa, thank you for sharing your story. This says, great discussion. As a 57er, single, female, never married, no kids, renter, no super for the first 20 years of my working life, only recently secure after receiving inheritance. I'm still trying to find work. Now a lawyer. Very scary years in my 50s while I'm studying. Just finally, Jeanette, for women in particular that are listening to this, and whenever we discuss it, there are many women that are saying, I'm really frightened that that's my future. Can they reach out to you at the Women's Property Initiative? Can they go for help? There are solutions that are being generated by the community and by organisations like yours.
We absolutely are developing solutions, Rochelle, but we also need the funding to actually roll those solutions out. So, as I said, we did a pilot, an older women's housing pilot, which is fantastic. That was fully philanthropically funded. Now, that should be a demonstration to government of, well, this can work, this can operate, this is what's needed for some. And we are talking about older women who have a little bit of money behind them. We're not talking about those who have absolutely no money behind them. And there's a great deal of those as well, as we know when we're talking about...
Yeah, but whether we're relying on public or private. Jeanette, thank you so much. I suggest that people go and have a look at some of the incredible work that you're doing. Thanks for spending time with us. Jeanette Large, the CEO of the Women's Property Initiative, relying on philanthropic funds, probably boomer money there, maybe, to bring it all back around, as finally Dan Woodman. I mean, we didn't even touch on, you know, the emergence of hippies and flower power and the interconnection between music and politics. I think the main thing that's come out of today is that the stereotyping, it's pretty rampant.
Yeah. There were so many wonderful things that have come out of the life of these cohorts. But today we have felt that kind of pushback against, I guess, the stereotypes that are more negative. But I think the discussion at the end reminds us that there's so many other things that shape our life, you know, our gender, our socioeconomic status. But also those are things that can tie us together across generations as well. So there's also those solidarities that can come from recognizing
our different experiences and hopefully setting up our policies so that the people don't fall through the cracks between the different schemes we set up.
And I think the word that Professor Clive Hamilton used, bitter, really struck with me because it does feel bitter, a lot of the debate at the moment, and I hope that that falls away because no one is to blame. If opportunities were given to you in a particular generation and you took them, then so be it. There are different times, different measures, different positions that you're in. But the blame game doesn't help anyone, does it?
No. Well, last time we were talking about Gen X's as that kind of forgotten generation in the middle, I was struck today by this sense of bitterness and pushing back against the boomer millennial wars, I guess. When most of the politicians making our policy now, like the boomers are still an influential voting bloc, but so are the millennials. And the people making the decisions are actually the Gen X's.
God help us all. Because that's us. As always, Dan Woodman, Professor of Sociology at Melbourne University. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. Don't forget, The Conversation Hour is a podcast. Go to the ABC Listen app. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Thanks.